Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. An FDA advisory board recently recommended the agency withdraw approval of Avastin for those suffering from advanced breast cancer. The drug was part of an accelerated approval process the agency uses for medications that could help those suffering from life-threatening illnesses. Here in the studio to talk about what this means for patients and doctors, Dr. Carolyn Hendricks of Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, and Gardner Harris of the New York Times. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And joining us from Southampton, New York, is Dr. Peter Bach of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute. Good morning, Dr. Bach.
Good morning, Diane.
And by phone from North Carolina is William Hubbard, former Associate Commissioner for the FDA. Good morning to you, sir. Welcome back.
Hello, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And throughout the hour, we do invite listener comments, calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Hendricks, if I could start with you, tell us what Avastin actually is.
Avastin is a medication that is used for the treatment of breast cancer and other solid tumors. My experience is mainly with breast cancer. Avastin is not a chemotherapy drug. It is administered intravenously. It's a medication that is a new concept in cancer treatment. We know that cancer cells need blood vessels to grow and spread throughout the body. And Avastin was developed as a medication that can prevent or inhibit cancer cells from creating new blood vessels. So it has an effect on cancer cell blood development, and that is the way that's the way it works.
And Gardner Harris, I gather it was used or approved for use in other cancer treatments.
Absolutely. It's improved in colon, liver, kidney, and lung cancer and has shown some benefit, although in none of these cancers is the benefit particularly great. I mean, it's a very expensive drug, Diane. It's what's called a monoclonal antibody. It came out of work by Judah Folkman, who came up with this brilliant idea that if you could cut off tumors from their blood supply, you could kill them. And so there was enormous hope around this drug when it first came out. There is an enormous price tag associated with it as well. It costs about $88,000. But the trials of the drug have failed to show that it works particularly well. And as these most recent trials in breast cancer show, it doesn't work at all in breast cancer.
Dr. Hendricks, did you use the drug? Did you prescribe the drug for your breast cancer patients?
Yes, I do. So when it was first given this accelerated approval several years ago for patients with advanced breast cancer who need chemotherapy, who have not received previous treatment for advanced breast cancer, I have used the combination of Avastin and chemotherapy for
and
my patients.
How did it seem to work?
Well, it was very exciting. When the data was first presented to the FDA, some of the responses that we saw in clinical trials and in my practice were very dramatic. In other words, patients might be very seriously ill from advanced breast cancer. And when this combination of medications worked, it would be very dramatic and very rapid. But on the downside, when the breast cancer recurred, that was also quite rapid. And in that instance, the breast cancer then became more difficult to treat.
So, turning to you, Dr. William Hubbard, we've heard about this accelerated process. Talk about the process for approving this Avastin drug in breast cancer.
As you said at the outset, Diane, it's a policy to get new drugs for serious diseases on the market as quickly as possible. So, in the case of cancer, FDA under this policy can use something called a surrogate endpoint, an interim measure, to get the drug approved and then ask the company that makes the drug to study it further. So in this case, an interim measure could be that the tumor stopped growing or even shrank. And then FDA can determine that that's a good thing, and it's essentially a marker for the likelihood that the patient will live longer. So FDA could approve the drug under this tumor shrinkage or a theory, and then the company would do more studies. In this case, when the advisory committee to FDA reviewed the data back in 2008, it found very limited benefit, but FDA still approved the drug because there was some benefit. Now a new study has come in showing perhaps even less benefit. So FDA is in the position of needing to decide whether to keep this very expensive drug and of limited value perhaps on the market. And it raises an age-old issue of whether FDA should wait for the best evidence and get the best drugs on the market, or whether it should be more bold in taking chances with diseases like cancer, taking greater risk, accepting greater risk. And FDA's now got to decide whether to remove this indication. It won't remove the drug from the market because, as Gardner said, the drug is approved for other cancers.
Yes. And turning to you, Dr. Peter Bach, just how common is it for the FDA to accelerate approval for a particular medication?
It's a mechanism the FDA has had in place for, I guess, almost 20 years. I think they began in 1992. And the basic idea of it is that it takes rather a long time, years and years, sometimes in trials, for the traditional endpoints, ways of evaluating the drugs, to develop. Things like overall survival in cancers like breast cancer take years to actually see. And so the notion behind it is that there may be earlier signs that a drug is either working or not working that indicate that the drug is likely to have this overall benefit or not.
But,
and so there's been a number of cancer drugs that have been approved through the accelerated approval process. Many of them in subsequent studies were shown to be beneficial, and in some cases subsequent studies or further follow-up has suggested that the benefit was not as large.
I see. But is there concern that in order to accelerate, there may be a compromise of standards, say, for safety and effectiveness, Dr. Bach?
Well, I don't think for safety, but for effectiveness, sure. It is, you know, as earlier person put it, this age-old trade-off between whether the FDA should be an extraordinarily high hurdle where nothing reaches patients until there's definitive evidence, or at the other end of the extreme, if the FDA should be essentially no impediment. And I mean, some people favor sort of abolishing the FDA and giving all patients access to even drugs in their phase one.
As the Wall Street Journal editorial page does, and of course they editorialized on Avastin yesterday. I mean, what's really going on here, Diane, is that we get hints about whether cancer drugs work through x-rays. I mean, we all look at our x-rays of tumors, and if a cancer drug can shrink the tumor, hallelujah, that sounds like it's a great deal. And Avastin was originally approved because it seemed to shrink tumors in breast cancer. But at the end of the day, we don't really care what your cancer looks like on x-rays. You care about if you get extra life. And so it takes longer in clinical trials to actually assess whether these drugs save people's lives. And it turns out that while Avastin might shrink your tumors somewhat in breast cancer, it doesn't actually extend your life. And it actually makes you sicker while you're already sick with breast cancer.
Doctor,
so it's a no-brainer decision not to take this drug, I think, right now for breast cancer.
Dr. Hendricks, you want to comment?
This is a difficult dilemma because I am in the community and I actually have these discussions with patients about metastatic breast cancer. There isn't any known cure, so any new medication that has that promise of the potential for cure or improvement in overall survival is very appealing to women. And the side effect profile of this medication is different than what we have have seen in the past with conventional chemotherapy. So the discussion that's occurring in the media now and in the FDA is not the discussion that I have with women in my consultation room.
Do you have any estimate as to how much time an extended life actually occurs with a patient taking Avastin?
Yeah, the initial study showed that there was an improvement of about 5 months in the period of time when their cancer did not progress. That was the first study. But when the other two studies were presented to the FDA, that amount of time had diminished on the order of just about 1 or 2 months, 1 to 3 months, I think. And so that's statistics. So when I'm in the office talking to a woman, I can say this medication is a new concept. It's exciting. It's promising, but so far the benefit is modest. And then the patient may come back to me and say, but I feel it would help me. Can I take this medication? I think it will help me.
Well, Diane, the only thing that helps is that your x-rays look better. I mean, this drug has never proven to extend life. And in fact, while the side effect profile is different, it's still very serious. Patients can experience real flu-like symptoms, febrile neutropenia, which is not, an insignificant disease. And the other thing that goes on here, and Peter Bach can talk about this because he studied it the best, is that Avastin is also part of this new class of extremely expensive drugs. And so what's happening at the FDA is that the drugs are getting less effective and more expensive.
Gardner Harris, he's science reporter for the New York Times, author of the mystery novel Hazard. We'll take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about Avastin and other drugs. Welcome back. We are talking about the drug Avastin and the accelerated approval that the drug went through. The question now becomes whether Avastin comes off the market as a breast cancer drug. It's already received FDA approval for other types of cancer. In this case, it's been shown to extend the life of some breast cancer patients for as much as 5.5 months. At the same time, the cost has been exceedingly high. Bill Hubbard, I want to ask you about that cost factor. Is that something that the FDA takes into account as it looks at the approval process for a drug?
No, Diane. FDA's statutory charge is to determine if the drug is safe and effective for its intended use, in this case, breast cancer. It's not supposed to take into account cost. Another part of the Department of Health and Human Services does, that's the Medicare program. They make a determination whether a drug is reasonable and necessary and can decide whether to reimburse for it or not. But the big issue here is if FDA says that this drug is not safe and effective for breast cancer, then the Medicare program and private insurers may determine they should not reimburse for it. So some patients would argue that they're essentially having the drug taken away from them because they can't get reimbursement.
Dr. Bach, have you heard from patients who are interested in the drug Avastin for breast cancer, and are they told about this cost factor?
Well, so let me clarify an issue. The Medicare program actually is not allowed either by law to take cost into account in its decisions about whether or not to cover drugs for cancer. And in fact, the law requires them to cover drugs for cancer for the labeled indications from the FDA, what we're talking about in the case of Avastin, and also for a number of other uses if other recognized experts think it's appropriate. So actually, Medicare can't look at the price tag of Avastin and say, well, we don't think the benefit is worth the cost and not cover it. We have no such system in this country. The private insurers can't do that either. They're largely regulated by laws that require them, again, to cover cancer drugs, irrespective of their costs, if you will, experts or the FDA think they work. So it is true that this decision by the FDA could have serious repercussions in whether or not insurance companies and the Medicare program pay for this drug, but it has nothing to do with its cost.
And hallelujah, Diane. I mean, this drug makes you sicker and doesn't extend your life. Why would you want to take this drug? There was a study that just came out yesterday about palliative care and cancer, and it was a landmark trial because it showed that those who get palliative care and cancer actually survive 3 months longer than those who don't. It turns out that when you feel lousy when you have cancer, you probably die earlier than when you don't feel lousy.
And you're saying that this drug makes you feel lousier.
Absolutely.
And what do you say, Dr. Hendricks?
I have to respond by saying that breast cancer is extremely complex, and the mechanism of action of Avastin is extremely complex. And oncologists in the community and academic oncologists believe there may be a subset of women whose tumors can be very targeted by these drugs, where we get a very impressive response, but we're not able to identify that group of women. The very successful drug, for example, Gleevec, which benefited strongly from accelerated approval, was found to benefit only a subset of patients with a certain type of solid tumor. So now the focus should be really trying to identify what subset of breast cancer is this class of compound really effective for, so that we can administer it to those patients and not the others.
Doesn't this get at the whole question of cost-benefit as far as medical care is concerned? I have an email here which says, I know it sounds as though I'm hard-hearted, but how can we evaluate the benefit of these costly drugs? Who decides if a drug that extends life by 2 months is worth a price tag of $10,000. Somebody has to pay insurance, taxpayers for Medicaid, Medicare, or private pay. Dr. Hendricks.
I agree completely. It's the cost. When I'm meeting with patients, I try not to use cost in my specific recommendations. But on the back end, I know I've got to purchase the agents, and then I've got to pray that I can get reimbursed. So it's kind of the elephant in the room when I'm actually meeting with these women to talk about treatment for advanced breast cancer.
Peter did a study recently.
Well, there's no question that in many of these situations, the patients getting the drugs actually have to pay for a portion of the drugs themselves. So it's very real for them. In Medicare, for people who don't have other types of insurance, they owe about 20% of the total cost of the drug and other fees. So it's a very meaningful financial obligation. And, you know, it's one of the leading causes of bankruptcy now in this country is sort of acute high-cost medical bills for acute conditions like cancer.
And the costs, as Peter's study showed in the NEJM recently, the costs of cancer drugs are going up logarithmically.
So
this is a problem that we're going to be facing more and more and more. And as Peter pointed out, everyone has to, if a cancer drug is shown effective, laws require Medicare and laws require private insurers to pay for it, even if that efficacy is at the price of, say, $300,000 for only a month's extra life.
So, Bill Hubbard, if the agency has recommended withdrawing approval of Avastin, what happens next?
Well, as we said earlier, the advisory committee to the FDA, outside experts have recommended to the FDA that they pull the approval for the breast cancer indication. If the FDA medical officers agree with that, then the drug will no longer be approved for breast cancer. Its approval for colon and other cancers, however, remain in state. The issue, of course, as we just discussed, is will an insurance company then reimburse for an unapproved indication? And in many cases, they don't want to do that because they see it as essentially an experimental use.
Because what you're saying is that doctors may still recommend it off-label. Is
Absolutely.
That correct?
It would still be legal to use it off-label, but the reimbursement issue comes into play at that point.
And how... Go ahead, Peter.
It's a very tricky issue, and I think one of the challenges in this discussion is whether or not the FDA's role is essentially to regulate or control the practice of medicine through the drug's label. And this is similarly a very contentious issue. Some who feel that basically these expensive drugs really should only be used on label for exactly the uses the FDA says are highly evidence-based, and others who feel like there should be more flexibility. I think Dr. Hendricks is expressing some of that nuance when she talks about individual patients who may or may not benefit, even if the group as a whole doesn't necessarily benefit. That's been an important interaction between FDA and clinical medicine. And the challenge we face is that as prices rise and toxicities rise of these agents, the trade-offs become much higher stakes.
So, to interrupt, Peter, but Gardner, now what happens? How much evidence-based is the decision of the FDA after this recommendation to withdraw approval comes?
Okay, well, so obviously FDA is going to make a decision in the next month or so.
Right.
It has a lot of information. I mean, oddly enough, the process is actually working terrifically well in the Avastin case. In many other cases, as many of your other experts know, the FDA does give an accelerated approval based upon one of these kind of quirky endpoints, like your tumors look better on x-rays, but I don't know if it actually makes you survive long enough, and asks the company to come up with better studies to see if actually people get better. And in the past, anyway, many of the companies never did do those follow-up studies. So FDA was never given the information to sort of see whether it had made the right decision in the first place. FDA now, as a result of new laws in Congress, has new powers to require drug companies to fulfill these clinical trial commitments. In this case, Genentech did fulfill its commitment. It ran two studies. We have very good information that Avastin doesn't work in breast cancer. Now, there may be some quirky patients out there that it could work for, but finding those patients is the job of researchers. It's not really the job of clinicians.
Dr. Hendricks.
Yes, I would like to respond because one negative effect of this decision, if it is made to withdraw the medication for metastatic breast cancer first-line treatment, I think will be a negative impact on the current clinical trials. The medication now is under current clinical trial for earlier stage breast cancer. And in my practice, I have approximately 50 women who are participating in those trials. The trials are ongoing. They utilize different combinations of chemotherapy. Maybe the chemotherapy component is not the right one. And so I would hate to see this decision have a negative impact on the ability for those trials to meet their goals and to really define what is truly clinical benefit in early stage breast cancer.
Now, are those 50 patients in early stage breast cancer?
Yes. Once the excitement and the enthusiasm rose, then clinical investigators and academic centers designed clinical trials to see if the medication would be effective in earlier stage patients.
I see. All right.
But I mean, it's good that the excitement has gone away a little bit. I mean, those patients need to know that Avastin may not work in early stage breast cancer because, again, these patients are not nearly as sick. Why should they take the risks of getting sick from Avastin? And the fact that insurers may no longer pay for Avastin in breast cancer would actually encourage them to go into clinical trials because they then get it free in clinical trials.
Bill Hubbard, how common is it for the FDA to withdraw approval of a drug that had already been approved through an accelerated process?
It's very rare. I believe only one has come off the market, a Pfizer drug. So FDA's decision-making under accelerated approval has tended to be very good in that the drugs have shown subsequently to work. As Gardner pointed out, some companies have not done the necessary studies, and FDA is pushing them harder to complete those studies.
Go ahead, Dr. Hendricks.
I do agree with the fact that the data now is not very convincing. It's actually disappointing, and medical oncologists in the community are disappointed with the results. But we don't want to lose the promise of women being encouraged to continue to participate in trials of this agent and other agents like it. I just want to remind the listeners that the medication Herceptin, which is also a monoclonal antibody and maybe one of the most important drugs developed for advanced breast cancer, had only a modest improvement in overall survival in advanced patients and now is the single most important drug in about 25% of new patients.
Dr. Carolyn Hendricks, she's a medical oncologist affiliated with Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. Let's go first to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Pat. You're on the air.
Yes, I've been listening to this. My wife has the four-stage, but I can't say that, so I say four-stage cancer. She's been on this Avastin for nearly 2 years. She goes and takes it and still goes back to work. Her CTC markers remain at zero. Her PET scans are very, very promising. This is a miracle drug. I can't help but believe that politics is involved, politics and profit. There's even some people who say this is the infancy of Obamacare. Now, I am really walking on thin ice when I say that, but a case could be made for it. If you go online, you will see there are many, many petitions out there with many thousands of women with positive comments talking about how this has given them the dignity and hope for a cure for cancer. My wife, like I say, has lived for almost 2 years now on this Avastin treatment. I just can't understand why a panel, and this is real hard for me to say, but if some of these experts had cancer rather than just studying it, I think the findings would be different.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Gardner Harris, the beginning of Obamacare?
Not at all, of course. This is exactly the system as it was before Obama. It is the system now. I think at some point in the future, again, given that cancer drug prices are rising as fast as they are, soon the new drug price in the next couple of years will rise up to probably $150,000 a year for cancer care for drugs that may provide only 2-3 months of benefit on average. I mean, at some point, we're going to need to put a system in this country about to decide whether we can afford these drugs. We do not have that system now.
Is our caller correct when he says that online there are thousands of individuals who say they have been helped by Avastin?
Absolutely. But again, I mean, I'm sorry, but these are anecdotes. They're not part. The reason for the importance of clinical trials is that when someone walks into your door when you're a doctor, an oncologist, you have no idea what it is that is helping this patient. You can throw any number of drugs at this patient, and the patient may live for 6 months. The patient may live for 10 years. But you have no idea what is working, and that's why clinical trials are so important.
And what about the business end of this? How much will companies lose if the FDA withdraws approval?
you know, Avastin is one of the biggest selling drugs in the world. It's a $5.5 billion seller, despite the fact that, again, it only provides a few months of life to those who take it. And you know, it is $88,000 a year for cancer patients.
And yet Pat says his wife has lived for years on this drug, Dr. Hendricks.
I have to say that's my frustration also, because some patients do have much longer responses. And in some cases, there is absolutely no response and you lose the patient very quickly to advanced breast cancer. And right now, there's just no way to tell. I do acknowledge that the overall benefit is very modest in terms of months. I get frustrated in oncology meetings when we have months, you know, 5.5 months. And I wish that was longer, but we are limited by the complexity of breast cancer.
And again, the 5.5 months is, again, just an indicator of X-ray. You know, this drug has never proven to extend life. And while it's nice to have good X-rays, life is the most important here.
Gardner Harris of the New York Times, Dr. Carolyn Hendricks. She's a medical oncologist at Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more of your calls, comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
They're back. Bedbugs are infesting retail stores and offices as well as bedrooms. What's behind their resurgence and what to do about it? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll go right back to the phones as we talk about the drug Avastin, used in numerous types of cancer successfully. But now the question has arisen as to whether FDA approval will be withdrawn for its use in advanced breast cancer. Let's go to Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Rosemary. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have two questions. Too often the risks of new treatments are underplayed. What actually are the harms from this? Does it, for example, hasten mortality? And secondly, when these drugs come out, there's often a huge amount of excitement, but then often we get the real data and then it says something different. How did the FDA define safe early on? And did they know or have any hint of the harms that are discovered?
All right. Thanks for calling. Dr. Hendricks, harms?
Well, the FDA did a very thorough analysis of the three clinical trials that were presented. In clinical trials, we grade side effects, meaning grade 1, 2, 3, and 4 would be death from treatment. A grade 3 side effect is a significant side effect that requires a reduction in dose or interruption in treatment. Grade 1 and grade 2 side effects are considered to be mild and moderate and don't affect the treatment. The complexity of the Avastin data is that the listeners need to remember that Avastin is given with chemotherapy, so a lot of the side effects that were reported were actually attributed to the chemotherapy and not the Avastin. The side effects from Avastin are unique, and they don't necessarily overlap with chemotherapy. Unfortunately, in the studies, there was a very small percentage of patients who died of complications that were attributed specifically to the Avastin, just under 2% of the patients.
And then there's bleeding and blood clots as well, Doctor, right?
Well, those are the side effects that you would attribute when the FDA analyzed the trials. They had to analyze whether the side effects were more typical from the chemotherapy part of the regimen or the Avastin. And again, since Avastin is affecting primarily blood vessels, those side effects were the ones that were attributed to the medication.
Bill Hubbard, can you talk about the evaluation of side effects during the approval process for acceleration?
Right. FDA does a risk-benefit analysis. So if you've got, for instance, a drug for a skin rash that would clear itself up in a couple of months anyway, FDA would expect very high safety profile. It would not accept much risk. Cancer drugs, however, are notorious for being unsafe generally. So FDA will accept a fairly high safety series of safety problems if the drug is showing benefit. So the medical officers at FDA are going to have to be weighing that slight 1, 2, 3 month survival against those risks, and that's ultimately the decision they will make.
And in this case, Diane, the placebo patients actually survived longer than those who got Avastin in both the most recent clinical trials. Statistically significant, but the placebo patients actually fared better in terms of living longer than those who got Avastin.
Here's a comment from Facebook. Seth wants to know, can you comment on methods such as genetic typing to select the patients who would benefit from the drug? Dr. Bach.
Yes, Diane. Most people will look at the data now for Avastin and respond the way Dr. Hendricks did, an earlier caller as well. Probably in that group, or we hope in that group, there's some women who are benefiting greatly. What the hard concept and the hard math here is that in order for the overall effect to be the same as placebo, that means some women are doing less well because of the drug. And so finding those women who could benefit or are more likely to benefit from genetics or some other sort of personalization is really going to be important in the next step. The Herceptin drug that Dr. Hendricks mentioned earlier is a drug personalized to the patient's tumor. So is Gleevec, another drug that's been mentioned on this show. And there's a number of other high-priced cancer drugs that have been increasingly tailored to patients based on the genetics of either the patient or their cancer.
And William Hubbard, how difficult is it going to be for patients who are seeking treatment with Avastin to get insurance coverage during this period of review of the drug?
Well, right now the indication is approved, so both Medicare and the private insurers will presumably continue to cover it. However, if FDA removes this approval for this indication, breast cancer patients could have a problem.
What are the other diseases for which Avastin is approved, Gardner?
I believe it's colon, kidney, and liver, and lung cancer. Those are the four, aren't they, Peter?
That's right.
Yeah. So it has shown very modest survival benefits in some of those other cancers. So obviously this drug will remain on the market. And Peter talked about this before. You know, what's really going on here, Diane, is that there has long been a tug of war between the FDA on the one hand and doctors on the other hand. Who really controls medicine? Who really controls these decisions? And then, of course, in the most recent years, because things have gotten so expensive, the insurers have started to get into this tug of war. And so, you know, Carolyn over here has historically, she and her colleagues have really been alone in the decision making about what drugs to prescribe their patients. Well, because the stakes now are so much higher, the power of that decision making is getting taken away from Carolyn.
And now we're getting several email questions about whether doctors profit from getting patients to use Avastin, or if they have any relationship with the company that manufactures it. Have you seen any evidence to that?
Well, Carolyn, I'm sure, here makes decisions based just on the evidence. But unfortunately, medicine in this country is a profit-based business. Doctors do get a markup from the drugs that they prescribe to the patients. And
what does that mean?
Well,
they get a markup.
They buy it from Genentech, and then they get reimbursed for more money than what they buy it for. Now, the system has changed in recent years with Medicare. They used to get considerably more money than what they buy it for. Now they only get sort of modestly more money than what they buy it for. And if you're maybe a single practitioner and you don't get particularly good discounts from Genentech, some oncologists have complained that they're actually making a slight loss on some of these drugs. But generally, oncologists make a considerable portion of their income in the drug markups. And of course, some 20% of physicians, according to data that the New York Times has analyzed, also make money directly from Genentech as serving as consultants. And so they get cash payments as consultants. Many doctors also take routine food. You know, many get delivered from drug sales representatives. So this is one of the reasons why I tend to trust FDA's decision-making more than I trust doctors, because FDA cannot be bought. And unfortunately, there's a lot of doctors out there who allow their opinions to be bought.
Dr. Bach, do you want to comment?
Yeah, Diane, I think Gardner is, you know, right on target here. There are a number of studies that have now shown that at some level, medical oncologists, the people who treat breast cancer, are influenced by the size of the profits they make on the drugs they use. Just a month or two ago, there was a study from Joe Newhouse at Harvard and some of his colleagues showing that a shift in the amount oncologists made on different drugs used to treat lung cancer led to an immediate shift in the drugs they selected towards the ones that were more profitable. So these are subtle and corrupting influences on the practice of medicine. I believe, as a practicing doctor, that they are small effects, and they probably affect only a minority of doctors. But they are there, and the data, the fact that you can see these shifts even in the Medicare program where the profit margins are relatively small, does suggest that it's one serious issue that we need to deal with and probably eradicate in order to get decision-making purely focused on the patient.
Dr. Hendricks, a direct and specific question for you. Do you make more of a profit dealing with an individual who wants Avastin?
Well, Avastin is particularly difficult. It's an expensive drug to purchase. There is reimbursement for it, but the lag time between the claims processing and the reimbursement actually is the biggest challenge that I face in my practice. It is true that the medications cannot be given negatively. If I had to give all purchase chemotherapy drugs and administer them to patients for less than it costs to purchase them, that I would not be able to maintain my practice. The dilemma is the time that it takes for insurance companies to process the claims, because they see the same sticker shock that I do.
Gardner Harris, I must say, this raises many questions about the practice of oncology. And as you said, the purchase of these drugs by oncologists and then the profit making that occurs because they do purchase these very expensive drugs.
Look, the system is sort of appalling and has been appalling, for a long time. And you know, it has gotten a little bit better. But, you know, if you have, for instance, you know, going beyond the Avastin, there are the EPO drugs, which are the erythropoietin stimulating agent drugs. And oncologists for a long time gave these EPO drugs sort of routinely in cancer because they thought that it would make their patients somewhat healthier, make them less likely to get anemic. It turns out that these EPO drugs, Amgen makes them, Johnson & Johnson makes them, Procrit is the big seller, one prominent oncologist called them the miracle grow for cancer. And if you have had a loved one die over the last 20 years of cancer, it's likely that that person got one of these EPO drugs, and it's there. It's certainly possible that that drug sped their death. And those drugs used to be a central profit center for oncologists throughout the country until finally these sort of data came in. And the fact that, you know, okay, the drug purchasing situation is a difficult situation for doctors. The consulting situation is not. The fact that doctors are willing to be paid by drug makers, some 20% of doctors out there serve as consultants to drug makers, and nearly 80% take gifts of real worth from drug makers that can influence their opinion. Their studies are absolutely crystal clear on this. And so I think when you have a doctor out there who is deciding to prescribe you, if you have breast cancer and you have a doctor who really wants to give you Avastin, I would worry about that doctor. I think you should get another doctor.
Gartner Harris at the New York Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Wagner, Oklahoma. Good morning, Linda.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a couple of comments and then a question. I'm a caregiver for a woman who 3 years ago was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer, which is a very aggressive cancer. It doesn't show up on mammograms. In fact, a lot of doctors, it's my understanding, misdiagnose it because it ends up presenting, first of all, like a bug bite. Within a week, her cancer had progressed. We were lucky to see a doctor very quickly. And within about 2 weeks of her first seeing symptoms, she was diagnosed with stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer, and it had spread at that point to about 5 other spots in her body, and we thought she might not make it for more than a few weeks. But we were lucky enough in rural Oklahoma to get hooked up with a surgeon and an oncologist who had just come out of the Sloan Kettering facility in New York and began to practice out here. They knew about Avastin. They knew enough to know that it was inflammatory breast cancer. They treated my friend with Avastin. And after just 2 treatments, they did another PET scan. There was no cancer shown anywhere. And that, I believe that the Avastin bought her the time to be able to undergo more traditional treatments like the mastectomy and the radiation and continued chemotherapy. After she had some of those treatments, they continued a little bit more of Avastin. I think she had like 6 treatments in all with other chemotherapy drugs. That was 3 years ago. But I believe that had she not had that time, those few months, she wouldn't have had the time to receive other treatments.
All right. Dr. Bach, do you want to comment?
Well, you know, Diane, this is the difficult issue. And first of all, I'm very glad that she is doing well. But this is the difficult issue. In these studies, hundreds of patients, hundreds of women, or thousands of women are studied. And on average, the effects are what we've been talking about. That doesn't mean that certain patients don't benefit, but it does mean that if some women are benefiting, then others must not only not be benefiting, but be doing worse, because there has to be counterbalance for the groups to do the same, whether they get the drug or not. And because we don't know in advance which women are likely to benefit and which ones are likely to be harmed, and that is how you get to that equality, you know, there's a bit of flying blind here. I do disagree with Gardner that you can judge an oncologist based on their decision about which drugs to prescribe. The monetary effects are corrupting, there's no question, But I firmly believe that oncologists have as their primary goal helping their patients, and they're trying to make good decisions around how to do that.
And finally, to you, Dr. Hendricks, if you continue to prescribe the drug after, if the FDA decides not to approve it in the use of treating breast cancer, who's going to have to pay for it?
Well, it'll be a difficult dilemma. I'm hopeful that patients who are currently receiving the drug can continue it. I think for the newly diagnosed patients, I will have to give them other options and, most importantly, encourage them to participate in new clinical trials of new drugs for breast cancer.
Of new drugs. Other new drugs. What a dilemma.
Yes,
how soon do you expect a decision, Gardner?
It'll happen relatively quickly in the next few weeks. And look, I didn't mean to obviously disparage doctors out there. They're making very tough decisions. Carolyn here, I mean, these are dying patients. They want hope. It's hard decisions.
Gardner Harris, science reporter for the New York Times. Dr. Carolyn Hendricks, she's a medical oncologist affiliated with Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. William Hubbard is former associate commissioner for the FDA. Dr. Peter Bach is attending physician, director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcome at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.